Anyway, he had gotten an invitation to speak for them some months ago, and then following that, that he had arranged for he and for him and I and me, he had arranged for him and me to speak in a weekend series. They have a retreat. They all go out to this resort down south of Lancaster, and I wasn't sure exactly who it was I was going to be speaking for. I knew something about youth. Well, it turned out it's all youth. It's basically junior high school and high school, about 30 young people, maybe some college, I'm not sure. Spoke twice yesterday, spoke once this morning, that's why I'm late getting back. We'll get to speak again tonight and tomorrow. And really, it's been a very good experience. I've been able to say some things and say them in a way, some things that are considered controversial in the religious world, but say them in such a way it just seems like they just kind of see it. I mean, I'm just reading an audience, but I sure didn't get tomatoes thrown at me or anything like that. But anyway, I want to say I appreciate the support that you all provide to me in multiple ways, certainly financially and just in your exhortations. You make it possible for me to not only work with the church here, but to take advantage of such opportunities as this. And it's just a great privilege that you provide to me to be able to do these things. But I'm here now and have a lesson to present to you. I often speak in a situation where I present 5, 6, 7 lessons, you know, boom, 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 over a weekend or maybe over a week, you know, every night, that kind of thing. Have I still not got that done right? Clint's going to take care of me. Let me do that. There we go. Is that what we're looking for? And when I do that, I'm usually preaching lessons that I have preached multiple times. So it's kind of easy, in a sense, you know, to speak several times over a weekend or over the course of a week. This weekend, twice yesterday, 3 times today, and once tomorrow, 6 times in 3 days. And most of what I'm saying out there is things that I've said before. But what I'm going to say to you today is a new lesson. And what that means is I'm not on autopilot. But it also means, because I'm focused on what I've been saying out there, it's not one of those unfinished lessons. It's finished, but it's not necessarily all in my head. So I may be a little dependent on the projector today. We'll see how it goes. But what I want to talk to you about today, and actually in a few lessons this month, is the Christian and government. This is kind of a timely lesson, in a sense. We've got an election coming up. There are a couple what do we call them, the major party candidates that a lot of people are not particularly excited about. I think right now in the American public, both candidates in the major parties have a majority negative approval, so that's kind of an interesting situation. And so how do we think about all of this as Christians? Gardner Hall, for whom I have great respect, and many of you know him, was teaching this topic, Christian and government, the Christian and government, at the camp that Joe Works runs. Tim Dreger was there. Noah Andrews was there just a couple of weeks ago. And he had some really good things to say. And he kind of inspired me to think, you know, I can talk about this. I need to say some things about this. And the last point that I want to make today is a point that Gardner made, and I'd never really quite thought about it in exactly the way he talked about it, so that we'll get to in just a moment. But let's talk about the Christian and government, and let's just start off by acknowledging God uses government to keep order, and our allegiance, however, is elsewhere. We are citizens of a heavenly kingdom. And that's kind of the theme that we're going to be keeping in mind in both this lesson and some other lessons that I want to present this month. You know, when we look at the Bible, we see Paul appealing to Caesar, certainly using the rights that he had as a Roman citizen. We see, what's his name? Was it Erastus? I'm calling him blank. Let's turn to Romans chapter 16. And I don't have my New Testament. I don't know what I did with it. All right. If one of you turns to Romans chapter 16 and look in the last paragraph there and see if you see Erastus, that name mentioned there. Anybody have that? Clint, can you read that verse, please?
Mm-hmm. Gaius, my host, and the host of the whole church greets you. Erastus, the treasurer of the city, greets you.
So Paul is writing this letter from Corinth, and apparently Erastus is the treasurer of the city at Corinth. And that's kind of interesting because there is, that you can see today, a paving stone over there in Corinth that has been preserved, and it has the name of Erastus, is it, as a city official in Corinth from the first century. And it's thought that that is most likely this very same Erastus. But the simple point that I want to make is, here we have a Christian serving in a role in government. And so we see that kind of thing. But what we really have to keep in mind is that though God uses government to keep order, and though we may take advantage of the privileges or the rights that we are granted by government, may even work in some capacity in government, that we are citizens of a heavenly kingdom. Our allegiance is not to the United States of America. And as heretical as this may sound in our patriotic nation, it's not to the flag of the United States of America. It is to our God. And so we want to think about that as we go through this lesson. And the phrase that Gardner was using is otherworldliness. Just this concept that we actually belong in another world. And he had an interesting way of illustrating this. Gardner spent time in other countries, and I think he was talking particularly about when he was in Argentina. How many of you have spent more than a couple of weeks in another country, or at least a week or so? Wow, a lot of you. Okay. When you are there, and this is the point Gardner was making, when you are there, are you interested in what's going on in that country? If you have a chance to read, if you're there for a month or so, you've been overseas for a month or so, more. If you're there for a month or so, you've been, do you pay attention to the news from the United States? Sure you do. Gardner did. I do. I was in Moscow on New Year's Eve or New Year's Day one time, and I did my best to find a Wi-Fi connection in a hotel where I could watch an Alabama football game. Back here in the United States, if we go to this country on earth and we're citizens of another country on earth, but we're visiting in this foreign country, though we may have an interest in the affairs there, our primary interest really is still what's going on back home. Well, as Christians, our home is in heaven, and we are citizens of a spiritual kingdom. And as citizens of a spiritual kingdom, that's where our primary interest should lie. And while we're here in this life, we may be fascinated by, interested in, the things that go on in the political landscape, in the particular nation in which we are living, but our primary interest is elsewhere. Now, when we look at the Bible, one of the concepts that we see is God rules over the kingdoms of men. You'll remember Nebuchadnezzar in the book of Daniel. Nebuchadnezzar was a great, powerful king, and he had a dream. And the dream was one in which God warned him, this is all going to be taken from you. And then Daniel tells him, you know, if you will do what is right, maybe you can postpone this judgment that's coming. But 12 months later, Nebuchadnezzar was walking on his palace roof, or maybe in his palace somewhere in Babylon, where he could see. He looked around and he said, is this not great, this Babylon that I have built? And what was that attitude there? It was one of arrogance and pride, and look at what I have done. And so the judgment of God came upon him that he would be like a wild animal out among the beasts, the Most High, until he learned that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whomever he wishes. So here's Nebuchadnezzar, and he thinks that he is ruling by his own might, and God is letting him know, you don't rule at all unless I say so. God bestows it on whomever he wishes. God raises up rulers, and God brings them down. We have the case of Daniel chapter 2, verse 21, where, again, in a dream that Nebuchadnezzar has, that Daniel interprets, this statement is made, talking about God, he removes kings and establishes kings. And then we have Psalm 75 and verse 7, but God is the judge. He puts down one and exalts another. And this is true whether it be a good king, like David, Acts chapter 13 and verse 22 says, he raised up David to be their king. Or if it is an evil king, like Pharaoh. In Romans 9:22 says, for the scripture says, Pharaoh, for this very purpose I raised you up, to demonstrate my power in you, and that my name might be proclaimed throughout the whole earth. This is referring to the Pharaoh who was in charge in Egypt at the time that the Israelites were slaves. And God brings the plagues upon the Egyptians. And you'll remember that the first plagues that he brought, in fact, even before the first plague, Moses and Aaron walked in with the staff and threw it down, and it became a snake. And that would be pretty impressive to me, as Libby says. In my way of thinking, there are three kinds of snakes: live ones, dead ones, and sticks that look like snakes. And I'm afraid of all of them. They put that rod down there, and it turns into a snake. Yup, fine, go, do what you want, leave. Not Pharaoh. He called his magicians, and the magicians do the same thing. So you have to ask, well, did God not know that they could do the same thing? Why didn't he pick a better trick? It wasn't a trick from God, it was a trick from the magicians. Well, why didn't God pick something that they couldn't do? God wanted to multiply his signs, and he's going to let Pharaoh be stubborn. I want you to just think about how God manipulates this man. God put him in power. God knew what kind of heart he had and how he would be stubborn given the opportunity. And God manipulated that man, and it allowed multiple plagues. The first two plagues that were brought upon the Egyptians, the Pharaoh's magicians could imitate with their secret arts. And the third one they couldn't. And when they couldn't imitate the third one, they said, well, this is the finger of God. And then they knew. But by then, Pharaoh was stubborn. By then, he had gotten set, and he's resisting. And so God now multiplies his plagues. And it became quite well known throughout the world, throughout that part of the world, what God ended up doing to the Egyptians. So God raised up David. God raised up Pharaoh. Let's focus on the purposes for which God raises up rulers. We have this statement here, to demonstrate my power with regard to Pharaoh. With regard to Jeroboam, you remember when Solomon was king, and Solomon committed idolatry, he married all those women that led him into idolatry, and he accommodated the idolatry. And so God says through a prophet to Jeroboam, I'm about to tear the kingdom from the hand of Solomon, and will give you 10 tribes, because they have forsaken me. He is going to set Jeroboam up as a king. And why? Well, as a judgment and as a response to the sin of the people. In the case of the king, in the case of Assyria, the whole nation, woe to Assyria, Isaiah chapter 10 verse 5 says, the rod of my anger and the staff in whose hand is my indignation. What God is doing here, he is using the Assyrian nation as his instrument, the rod of his anger, the staff, for his indignation, his instrument for bringing judgment upon the Israelites. And so God has his purpose there for using that nation. We're going to come back to Assyria in just a moment. With regard to rulers in general, those Romans chapter 13, and I didn't get the references up here, but this is three excerpts from the first 5 verses in Romans 16. Those which exist are established by God. It's a minister of God to you for good. It's a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. So what do we see there? God uses government to keep order in society. And then there's the proverb, Proverbs 8, verse 15. By me kings reign and rulers decree justice. Well, the thing is, discerning God's particular purpose with reference to any particular nation or any particular head of state, any particular ruler, any particular political leader, why is this man there? What's God doing with him? Discerning the particular purpose in that particular instance is difficult. In Habakkuk chapter 1, the prophet is crying out about the wickedness of the Jews, of Judah. And God, why aren't you doing something about this? You know, we're wicked. And God says, well, I've got something in mind. I'm going to bring the Babylonians, the Chaldeans. And the prophet's response is, wait a minute. They're worse than we are. So we pick up the reading in Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 5. Look among the nations. Observe. Be astonished. Wonder. because I'm doing something in your days you would not believe if you were told. For behold, I'm raising up the Chaldeans. You know, from a human perspective, if we're just surveying the nations at the time and we're looking around, well, which nations is God pleased with? And which ones is He going to prop up? And which ones is He going to bring down? We'd have looked at the Babylonians like that prophet did. We'd have said, well, they're really bad. God's sure not on their side. And He wasn't on their side in the sense of condoning them. But God's going to use them to bring down Judah. It goes on, it says, why do you look with favor? This is the prophet now responding to God. Why do you look with favor are those who deal treacherously? Why are you silent when the wicked swallow up those more righteous than they? Here's these Babylonians. They're worse than we are. And they're going to swallow up us? You know, looking at it from a human standpoint, it's kind of hard to figure out. Why is God doing this the way He's doing it? And God can use rulers, whether good or evil, for His purposes. Discerning God's purposes is especially difficult when a nation is strong militarily and having success. Because we tend to look at success and strength as an indication of God's approval. Well, God has blessed this nation. God approves of this nation. And you know, we think of the United States of America. And we still say, and we still hear people say, it's the strongest nation on the earth and the strongest military and all that kind of thing. So God approves of our nation. But you see, that's a fallacy. That's a flaw. In Habakkuk chapter 1, here's the description of Babylon. They are dreaded and feared. Their justice and authority originate where? With themselves. Now here is an important lesson. They were strong. Militarily, they were powerful, and God is going to allow them to persist for a time, and in fact, He is going to use them to bring judgment upon the Jews. But their authority, the way they are thinking of it, it originates with themselves. They're not honoring God. Their horses are swifter than leopards and keener than wolves in the evening. Their horsemen come galloping. Their horsemen come from far. They fly like an eagle swooping down to devour. That sounds like a pretty powerful and pretty successful nation. The text continues. All of them come for violence. Their horde of faces moves forward. They collect captives like sand. They mock at kings, and rulers are a laughing matter to them. They laugh at every fortress and heap up rubble to capture it. Then they shall sweep through like the wind and pass on. But they will be held guilty, they whose strength is their God. That's a scary proposition for the United States of America, a scary statement. They whose strength is their God. Too much the concept in our country is our military gives us our blessings. Our military gives us our freedom. I admire any young man who sees something of value bigger than himself. Something worth standing up for. And something worth giving himself for. Those are noble ideas. But in our desire to honor those ideas, we will often talk about the freedom that we have, we owe to those who have fought our wars. I want to tell you something. The freedom that we have, we owe to God. It would not matter how strong we were, how valiant our warriors were, if it were not God's will that we be free, we would not be. And it doesn't matter how poor our munitions stores are. It doesn't matter how inept our soldiers are. If God wills us to be free, we will be. God is in control. The Babylonians made the mistake of saying, we are great because we're great. We are powerful. We are strong. And the last statement is, their strength is their God. Let's not make that mistake. we as Christians who are citizens of a heavenly kingdom should of all people find it easy to step aside and say, wait a minute. We are citizens of a kingdom whose king is over everything. And he's the one who decides whether the United States of America is free or not, whether or not the United States of America stands. Where is my clicker? There it is. I want to ask you this, and this is the point, and I'm not going to try to claim that I'm making it exactly as Gardner made it, but this is a point that Gardner made that I thought was an interesting point, and I want you to consider with me. When God brings our nation down, what should our attitude be? And I have the word "our" in quotation marks here because this world is not our home, and the United States of America is not our home. We are citizens of this country politically, yes. And we have a responsibility as Christians to honor the king, or in the case of this country, we don't have a king, honor the leaders, to obey the laws of our land, to pay our taxes, all of those things. But in our hearts, we need to think of ourselves as citizens of a heavenly kingdom. So that's why I have the word "our" in quotation marks. As we contemplate this question, when God brings this nation down, what should our attitude be? And we can find a biblical parallel that will maybe help us think about that, but not in Old Testament Israel. That's not a good place to go for a parallel. Because if you think of the Old Testament Israelites, they were citizens of a theocracy. The kingdom of which they were a part was indeed from God. It was ruled by David and his descendants, from whose line comes Jesus. In other words, Jesus sat on the same throne that their king sat on. In other words, they were citizens of a kingdom that was both a kingdom on earth and God's kingdom at the same time. And so when God brought judgment upon that kingdom, God's people could rightly say, this is a shame to us. I mean, this is a reproach upon us. We're God's people. And we have acted in such a way that God's judgment is coming upon us. But the United States of America is not that. And whether it be the United States of America, or whether it be China, or whether it be Japan, or Germany, or Argentina, or whatever it is, Christians in these countries today, when God brings judgment upon these nations today, they should not look at it as, oh no, this is a reproach upon Christians because this nation is God's nation. Mm-mm. God rules over the affairs of man, and it's God who determines who's going to be raised up and put in power, whether good or whether evil. But none of these nations are equivalent to the Old Testament theocracy of Israel. But let's come down to this next bullet here. When Old Testament Israel suffered defeat, it was a shame to God's people. Here's the next one I want. When our, in quotes again, nation today suffers defeat, it's not a shame to God's people. It's a shame to this nation. It's a shame to the people who are wicked. But is it a shame to the Church of Jesus Christ if the United States of America falls? Is it a shame to the Church of Jesus Christ if Russia or Ukraine or the Congo or whatever nation it be falls? You see the distinction I'm making? We truly are citizens of a different kingdom. But we can find a parallel that will help us. And that is, if we follow the earthly nation of Israel through to the New Testament, now we come to a time when really no longer are we talking about the covenant people of God. The Israel of God is made up of both Jews and Gentiles who have recognized Jesus Christ as the Son of God. The Israel of God is not those who are circumcised outwardly, but those who are circumcised inwardly when we get to the New Testament. There is the Jerusalem from above in Galatians chapter 4. And then there is the earthly Jerusalem that is comparable to Hagar in Galatians chapter 4. And so when we get to the New Testament, we can look at Jewish believers who are part of the Jewish nation on earth, but who are, more importantly, part of spiritual Israel, the Israel of God. And then we can see in them, we can see ourselves in them, if we think about what it was like for them to be told, Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. The nation of Israel on earth is going to be judged. What was their attitude? And that's kind of like what our attitude should be when we see the nation in which we live, the earthly nation, the United States of America, being judged. Were they sad? Yeah, they were sad, no doubt. Anybody's sad to see the place they've lived and the people amongst whom they've lived being destroyed. But let's turn to Luke chapter 21 and verse 20. And Jesus, talking about the judgment that's coming upon Jerusalem, says, "When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her desolation is near. Then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains, and those who are in the midst of the city must leave. And those who are in the country," meaning out in the rural areas, "must not enter the city." Don't come back to the city. It's going to be destroyed. It's not a safe place. "Because these are days of vengeance, so that all things which are written will be fulfilled." Now, if you're a Jew who is a believer, if you are a Jewish Christian in the first century, and you're aware this destruction is coming, Jesus has said it's coming, and it came within 40 years of when Jesus spoke these words. You're aware this is coming. What is your attitude? Is your attitude, "No, no, this can't happen. This is my country. I've got to defend it to the death"? No. This is God's judgment. This is a vengeance that God is bringing about. And I may live there, and I may be sad that this is happening, but I am a citizen of a heavenly kingdom. And that's not going to be changed by the destruction of Jerusalem. Verse 25, "There will be signs in sun and moon and stars, and on the earth dismay among nations in perplexity at the roaring of the sea and the waves, men fainting from fear and the expectation of the things which are coming upon the world. For the powers of the heavens will be shaken, then they'll see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory." I don't have time this morning to do this, but we've talked about on previous occasions how in the Old Testament, various times that nations were judged by God, various times in history when nations were brought down, it was described as a coming of the Lord, a coming of the Lord in the clouds, or a coming of the Lord, a day of the Lord, when the sun, the moon, and the stars would not give their light, when they would go dark. That was language that was used to basically say, "Babylon, for you, the lights are going out." Or, "Egypt, for you, the lights are going out." And that language is now being used with reference to earthly Jerusalem. And here are those people who are Jews, who are Christians, who are believers, and they are truly citizens of the Israel of God. What's their attitude? "Well, I've got to fight those Romans who are going to destroy the city and defend my country to the death." No, because we're not citizens of that country. Oh, yes, we have citizenship in a political way, but our allegiance is to a heavenly realm. So, when God brings our nation down, what should our attitude be? Well, it should be one of trusting God, of confidence that God is in control, that God's will be done, and that God's kingdom has been established forever, and that we are going to prevail. We won't have that mindset, and we won't be part of that ultimate victory if we get too entwined with the kingdoms of earth in our inward thinking, in our mindset, in our mentality. Let's live in this world as in the world, but not of the world. That's the lesson that I want to bring to you this morning. We'll talk a little bit more about some ideas about our relationship with the government and how we think about it. Some more lessons this month. Not all month long, but a couple maybe. Let's stand and sing the song that's been announced.